Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So I think in especially in national security community, you folk tend to focus on downside risk. So, you know, what could happen, what could go wrong. You tend to not focus on the upside risk, which are the opportunities that these people can bring into the organization.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Olivia Shen, Director with the ANU National Security College. Today's podcast is recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and we pay our respects to their elders past and present. This episode is part of our mini-series focusing on cultural and linguistic diversity in the Australian national security community. Today, we'll be zooming in on the experiences of Chinese Australians, which has seen its fair share of change through the ups and downs of the bilateral relationship. And I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Jennifer Stu, Project Director of the Multiculturalism, Identity and Influence Project at the Lowy Institute, and Yun Zhang, current Australian Institute of International Affairs China Matters Fellow and a former Commonwealth public servant. Welcome, Jennifer and Yun.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone.
Now, I might start with you, Jennifer. You're the lead author of the Lowy Institute's Being Chinese in Australia research, and this is a multi-year survey of public opinion in Chinese communities. You guys recently released the latest round of research reports in April. Can you talk us through some of those findings and the key ways in which Chinese Australians' views on national security and foreign affairs differs from the rest of the Australian population?
Yeah, so let's start with some broad findings and questions we've tracked over the last 3 years. And that is, 92% of Chinese Australians rate Australia as a very good or good place to live. And concomitantly, 75% say they have a moderate or great sense of belonging to Australia. And experience of discrimination, particularly around experience of physical threat and abuse, have declined by 4% over the last year to 14% in the latest survey. And, you know, there's a great deal of confidence and trust in Australia and the Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, more so than any other countries we surveyed or any other leaders we surveyed in the past years. So I think on the whole, there is that narrative that there is a lot of confidence and trust in Australia and Australia's Prime Minister. But I guess on the flip side is when we survey Chinese Australians and their sentiments towards broader geopolitical issues, such as, you know, threat perceptions around military conflict, trust in leaders like Xi Jinping or Vladimir Putin, for example, there are just, I think on the whole, less of a threat perception level among Chinese Australians compared to the broader Australian population. We use the Lowy Institute poll 2022 as a comparison point around those issues. And I think that says something about, you know, the lived experiences of Chinese Australians, whether they come from the People's Republic of China or Taiwan, who see themselves as Chinese, or, you know, Southeast Asia. So I think I'll leave it here and we can get into sort of more specifics of those data points in the conversation. But I think we start with sort of positive findings about sense of belonging, pride in Australia and confidence in Australia and Australia's Prime Minister.
That all sounds really positive. And it's interesting to see that that sense of belonging has held pretty strong and has actually increased, considering the ups and downs in the broader kind of relationship between the two countries. Does your surveys, and particularly sort of in the focus groups, does it pick up on how some of the political and economic tensions in the bilateral relationships, how they've impacted Chinese Australians, whether it's in their personal or professional lives or that sense of belonging?
Yeah, so one of the questions we've asked over the last few years is, do you see China as economic partner or security threat more? And 7 out of 10 of Chinese Australians say China is more of an economic partner rather than a security threat. And that statistic has held relatively the same over the last 3 years. And in the focus group, we fleshed this idea out. And I think for the most part, irrespective of place of birth, or country of origin, for example, for those who identify with having Chinese heritage, there is just a more practical outlook on how Chinese Australians see China. It's more, for many who've migrated from China or from the region, have small businesses or small medium entrepreneurs who to some extent rely on, economic engagement or trade engagement or the flow of international Chinese students to their small or medium businesses in sort of capital cities across Australia. So I think on the whole, there are a sort of more practical outlook as to how Chinese Australians see China. And that threat perception is much lower amongst Chinese Australian communities than, say, compared to the broader Australian population.
Yeah. So it sounds like they have a bit more of a pragmatic and multifaceted view on the relationship. That's kind of reflects more of their lived engagement with China and with the Chinese diaspora as well.
That's right. So for those who've migrated to Australia or those who are first or one and a half or second generation Chinese Australian, they have sort of more intimate or media ties to China, whether it is through family, whether it is through business, or whether it is through, sort of more media consumption, I guess. There is just that much more of an intimate connection to what is happening at the local level in China. And through lived experience, their engagement, for example, with customers who are from People's Republic of China, whether they be international students or tourists, for example.
Can I ask you a question about one and a half generation? That's not actually a term I've heard before. Can you unpack that a bit for me?
So I think Yun and I had this discussion before, right? So I wasn't born in Australia. I was born in Taiwan. My grandparents were born in China and left China in 1949 to go to Taiwan. And my parents and I migrated to Australia, more than 30 years ago. So I'm not first generation. I guess my parents will be first generation, but I'm not second generation. Second generation will be those who were born in Australia with ethnic Chinese heritage. So I'm somewhere in between. So one and a half. So, with both one foot there and one foot here, I guess.
And they often experience unique challenges with identities because, they're neither first generation nor second generation. And growing up, I grew up in Newcastle where it wasn't very diverse, and that posed some challenges for myself.
That's a really interesting way to conceptualize it. And I think that probably connects with the lived experience of a lot of Chinese Australians, that one and a half. But it's nice to have you guys kind of put a name to it. Like, I feel sort of the same. Like, I grew up in Lane Cove, which in the 90s was not very diverse for Chinese Australians at all either. That being said, I think the Australian Bureau of Statistics is having a meltdown right now about how they're going to record the experience of one and a half generations and include it in census surveys. So Now, Jennifer, I know that there has been some criticism of the methodology that you guys have used for the research, particularly Professor John Fitzgerald, China scholar at Swinburne University, has sort of criticised your inclusion of Chinese students and short-term residents in the research, and that may have skewed the results in his perspective. What's your response to that?
So, I mean, yes, I'm glad we're having this discussion around methodology and, you know, broadening to this discussion to which the Australian newspaper published Professor Fitzgerald's op-ed, and myself and my research director, Hervé Lemieux, wrote a response to that. And our response is that it's important to include a diversity of voices, particularly so we include Australian citizens, permanent residents, and those who are here in Australia on a long-term visa of a year or more. And that includes Chinese, international Chinese students and workers coming to Australia to work as well. And I think it's important to include these people because many do stay on and seek pathways to permanent residency and ultimately Australian citizens. And so if we ignore that part of the population who are also tax payers or contribute to the economy in some way, but they don't have a voice, and when they actually get to that pathway to citizenship or permanent residency, we miss a gap in their lived experience in Australia, and we miss the opportunity of hearing what they have to say about a range of issues. And I understand Professor Fitzgerald's concern, but I think the survey allows for a diversity of opinions, and it's called Being Chinese in Australia for a reason.
Mm. That's a good point.
And many of them also are still politically engaged despite being not Australian citizens, international students. They do have elections on campus, and some of the permanent residents go out for, they participate in campaigns for political candidates as well.
Yeah. So I think for the most part, we stand by the methodology. And, you know, we only have to think about sort of the review that came out of Home Affairs around the migration system recently, and what the Home Affairs Minister had to say at the National Press Club a couple of months ago about the difficulties and challenges for migrants who come to Australia, and that pathway to transition from, say, a student to worker to permanent residence to citizenship is fraught and difficult for so many people. And to miss an opportunity to hear what they have to say about, you know, that often there's a lot of positive things. And in the focus groups, it's an amalgam of different Chinese people of Chinese heritage, citizens, permanent residents, international students, workers. And on the whole, over the last 3 years, having done 15 focus groups with over 100 Chinese Australians, on the whole, there is a positive view about Australia and living in Australia. But those challenges of becoming permanent resident, our citizens, is an everyday lived experience for these people.
Yeah. And it also reflects that, you know, like you said, it is a long process to get to that point. But I think it also reflects that legal status and how it connects with identity can be quite subjective, mm-hmm. and your legal status might not necessarily reflect how you see yourself as a citizen of a country.
That's right. I know quite a few people from Southeast Asia, from say Malaysia or Vietnam, and they have never been to China, but they still see themselves as Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College.
Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
So then if we can sort of think about what are some of the policy implications of the surveys and the research work you've done and those public opinions, particularly where they differ from the rest of the Australian population, can Jennifer or Yoon, would you like to kind of comment or frame that?
Yes. Yeah, so around, so in the survey we ask about, and this is also asked in the Lowy Main poll as well, Chinese Australians and Australian population and their threat perception level around, you know, traditional and non-traditional threats. So let me just start, for example, with a non-traditional threat, climate change, for example. On the whole, Chinese Australians have lower threat perception level about climate change and its potential impact for Australia's vital interests in the next 10 years. There's 36% say it is a critical threat. 36% of Chinese Australians say it is a critical threat, climate change, compared to 64% of the broader Australian population. And that is climate change being a critical threat to Australia's vital interests in the next 10 years. So there is quite a big gap between the two population groups. But when we survey, you know, around traditional threat levels, so one of the option was potential for US and China to engage in military conflict over Taiwan in the next 10 years. That is the inverse. So for the Australian population, so the older you are as the broader Australian population, the greater your threat perception level about conflict is. Mm-hmm. But that does not hold true for the Chinese Australian population. It actually bounces around. So those who are 45 to 59 year old, who are Chinese Australians, have a greater sense of threat perception around conflict. And 60 plus have the lowest threat perception level around conflict between US and China over Taiwan. So how do we interpret these findings? If you just look at sort of Chinese Australian population, I think I can only think of, you know, my grandparents and my sort of older generation family members telling me, you know, wisdom comes with age.
Very Confucian, yeah. But also rather patronizing.
And it's going to be interesting to see how sort of some of those threat perceptions affect either activism or public discourse around these conversations. We've already seen sort of a heightened public discussion about the likelihood of a hot conflict over Taiwan. And there's a wide spectrum of views on the likelihood of that or the outcome. I think everyone agrees that the outcome would be horrendous, like the outcome of any war would be horrendous. But it really speaks to if a part of the population really believes that it's likely, as opposed to people who are hoping that with age comes wisdom and we can avert war, that kind of changes the conversation quite a bit.
Yeah, once you believe it is likely, I guess the next, so what you'll be focused on will not be how to avert the war because you already believe it is likely. Your focus then will be to, you know, to manage if a war happens and how to prepare for war. So I think the threat perception does change how you view the government should act.
Yeah, I think, you know, particularly the older Chinese Australians, say 60 plus, some will have migrated from China or elsewhere from the region, and they will have had sort of more direct experience with conflicts like the Vietnam War, the Korean War, even China's own civil war, right? And so if you've had those experiences of have witnessed, you know, conflict, then you would ask why, you know, surely policymakers or politicians will see the horrors of going to war, and that should serve as a lesson. So I guess, you know, I think of my grandparents who left China in 1949 as refugees and settled in Taiwan shortly thereafter. I think their experiences of civil conflict have really shaped, you know, my parents, their family, my family, that, you know, why would you engage in this kind of war talk when we've had that?
When we've had that lived experience, yes. And yeah. Clearly it's within our living memory, and it hadn't turned out well for anyone.
Yes.
Mm. So besides, you know, obviously averting actual war, do Chinese Australians have a view on what the government's policy priorities should be?
So in the focus groups, we asked, you know, about these issues. And again, there is a pragmatic view that Australia must do what is best for its national security interest. But it doesn't mean that there is a wholesale support for, you know, things like AUKUS or being closer to the US. I think the pragmatism stands from, we see the benefits that China brings economically, but also the security and the history that Australia has with US makes it somewhat inevitable that we will be drawn closer in times of uncertainty to sort of our natural allies, I guess. But I guess that's where, as a Chinese Australian, I see that tension, I feel that tension. Maybe if you didn't have that ethnic heritage, you wouldn't necessarily feel that. You know, can you sit on the fence, essentially, is the question, right? You see the benefits of both sides, but I think for many Chinese Australians, the idea is that Australia has had economic boon thanks to its trade with China, but given sort of the future outlook, the uncertainty, can Australia still have its cake and eat it too? That is, benefit from its trade with China, but becoming, you know, the alliance getting ever closer to the US. Because at some point that something's got to give, right? I think a lot of Chinese Australians will ask, well, or, you know, if they've come from China, they will see, well, at some point China's going to ask Australia, how can you continue to trade with us? How can you still benefit from this relationship when your defense posture, your national security policy is, you know, aimed at China or looking towards China as being the threat, right?
And conversely, the same ask might come from the United States.
That's
as
right.
Well, how can you continue your defense posture when your economic posture is so geared towards selling things to China?
Right.
Which I think is also probably a good way to segue into talking about Chinese Australians in the national security community, because some of those conversations and the policy advice and those decisions about alignment, about natural partnerships and how we either hedge or sit on the fence and how long that can last. A lot of those conversations are happening in forums where there are fewer Chinese Australians present or Chinese Australians contributing to and informing those discussions. I want to start with you and by talking about research that you alerted me to by economists Bob Brunig, David Hansel and Nunu Nguyen, our colleagues here at the ANU. And they've recently released some research on promotions across the Australian public service. And what they found was that at every promotion point, Anglo applicants were more likely to get promoted over non-Anglo applicants. And in fact, the gap gets higher and higher the more you move up the APS ranks.
Hmm.
So from APS 4 to APS 5 and APS 5 to APS 6 levels, Anglo applicants were 1/10 more likely to be promoted. From APS 6 to EL1 levels, it was 1/4. From EL1 to EL2, it was 1/2. And from EL2 to SES, Anglo applicants were 60% more likely to be promoted.
you, and you're the one who sent me this article. What was your reaction to this? Did the findings surprise you, and sort of how does it compare to your research more specifically on Chinese Australian representation in the APS?
Unfortunately, it doesn't surprise me because you can see quite visually when you look through the organization chart of different departments that the SES represented there are not diverse. And the figures you cited, it's also really important to remember that those figures compound. So, you know, when you go from, for example, EO1 to EO2, there's already a small group that gets to EO2. And then from that small group to get to SES, it's even harder. Whereas for some other underrepresented groups, the disadvantage is early on. So it's harder to get to, say, EO1, EO2 level. But then once you get there, for some of them, it's actually easier to get to SES. But for CALD, the promotion is the number is dismal at every level, and that's compounded. So that's an important point to remember.
And I think it was also interesting, the research bears out that non-Anglo public servants are disadvantaged for promotion even if they were born in Australia, whether they were second generation or maybe 1.5 generation, or even if they had migrated well before starting primary school.
So that's right.
Language proficiency is clearly not the barrier here.
No, it's not. So I think it does strongly suggest that there is an institutional and cultural problem of potentially racial discrimination within the public service when it comes to promotion.
And I would just give a quick shout out also that this this research covered 10 years of data from census surveys and captures, I think, the experiences and the reporting of over 2 million public servants up to the year 2020. So it is a really comprehensive piece of analysis. So well done, Bob. He has an office just down the hall from us. Thanks for your research. And thank you for actually capturing some of that and bringing some data to the conversation as well. I think that's really important, and to see how those trends have shifted or if they haven't shifted at all.
Yeah, so that's another thing is that it appears that, some people say, oh, we just have to wait, that the problem will resolve itself, 5 years, 10 years later as the new migrants get more socialized. But I think this research does suggest that waiting is probably not the solution, that we need to take proactive measures to ensure that we capture the capability of CALD people in the APS.
And on that, what do you think would be some more proactive measures? And more broadly, why is it important to capture that capability?
So I'll speak from the perspective of Chinese Australian because that's where I've looked into. So, for example, Chinese Australians tend to have higher China capability than the general population. Learning a Chinese language, whether it is Mandarin or Cantonese or Shanghainese, is incredibly difficult for people whose first language, primary language, is English. But Chinese Australians, especially even in second generation, tend to have a higher grasp of the language and also the culture of China. So they have a higher China capability. Yet, a recent report has shown that those with China capability has in fact tried to hide their China capability due to the nasty and quite toxic public debate when it comes to China. So on the one hand, there is a group with China capability, and on the other hand, they are hiding their capability. And we see that from a lot of, SES, deputy secretary especially, or secretary level, they often say that APS needs more China capability, needs more Asian capability. Yet when we look at how Chinese Australians with capability are treated in the APS by their direct line managers, by middle managers, their capability is not being valued at all. I've spoken to a lot of Chinese Australians in the public service. And for example, some of them has been told that it's because of their ethnic background that they are being basically prevented from working on topics to do with China because there's a perceived conflict of interest. And that conflict of interest is due to that ethnic background. And that is a very worrying thing, the fact that they have China capability and we're not utilizing them.
I think Yun made a really good point to me about a month ago about how risk is being perceived within the Australian public service, that there's a negative risk perception of your ethnic heritage working on sort of these issues, right? Rather than seeing it as an opportunity, right?
Or an asset, a strategic asset. Yeah.
So I think especially in the national security community, the risk is often, tend to focus on downside risk. So, what could happen, what could go wrong? You tend to not focus on the upside risk, which are the opportunities that these people can bring into the organization.
Yeah, I think, you only have to think about the greater diversity of your pool of thinkers or policymakers, the greater range of your hypotheses and solutions to the problem. If everybody in the room looks like you, has the same experience, has the same background, then your solution or your hypotheses are going to be quite limited, right? Given that we live in a very complex world with complex issues, we need a diversity of thinkers. Policy prescriptions or policy thought to address those complexity that Australia or the region will face in the coming future. So I think definitely when Yun told me that we should see the ethnic heritage of the person working within this area to be an opportunity rather than as a downside is definitely one thing that I think is lacking in the conversation around cold representation in national security.
And it will lead to a severe problem of groupthink, where there's a group of people missing from the conversation or perspective that's missing from a conversation. That's what happens with groupthink, and the result, policy advice is suboptimal.
And that perpetuates the cycle as well, in a way, particularly if people do not feel that they are treated as an asset. The risk perception is a really interesting problem because I think as a national security community, we are trained to assess risk based on group characteristics, but it loses sight of the individual. And I know you recently wrote a piece where I thought it was really telling that you talked about how Australians lose sight of the Chinese people or China as a country made up of people, and they see only the state or they see the Communist Party.
That's right. And that goes back to the point with the survey before as well. With a lot of Chinese Australians, when they think of China, they think of their friends or relatives there. They don't see China as the other. Whereas for people with no personal or professional connections to China, when they think of China, they tend to think of as a immediately as a security threat, as the other, the communist. And that goes back to the Cold War impression as well. And that othering of China means that their threat perception of China probably is also higher.
It's especially problematic if we're othering Chinese Australians because they do have so much to contribute and a lot of them want to contribute. So how can national security agencies provide greater opportunities for Chinese Australians, as well as sort of retaining them throughout a career in the APS?
So first thing, of course, is to avoid seeing ethnic background or seeing diversity as a burden or as a risk. So we should treat people as individuals, as I was saying before. For example, And that's my personal experience and as well as experience of a lot of people I know, that when we go to a meeting, a classified meeting, often people will look at me, who being the only Chinese Australian in the room, and ask, do you have the right security clearance? Well, they don't ask any other person in the room for that. So that kind of a microaggression should definitely be avoided. So I think we need a lot of more cultural training, sensitivity training about how to manage that. And the second one is to really value the work of Chinese Australians. And that goes to broader, not just national security community, but broader APS.
For example, culled people are often asked to hold culled events, but those things tend to not get recognized. So you hold, you know, harmony week activities or morning teas. They often being asked to do that because one, culled people tend to be more junior. And yet these kind of activities, they don't get recognized. They don't count towards promotion. And a lot of the value they bring to the organization when they raise the different perspectives, often the middle managers, for example, at EO2 level or EO1 level, they don't really understand the different perspectives they bring in.
So I think it goes to some of the differences between diversity and inclusion. Mm. I think sometimes cold representation in the APS is recruited for diversity, but once they're inside the organization, is the rest of the organization supported and trained to include those perspectives? And on a day-to-day basis, whether it's from colleagues, from managers, not just from the HR team that talks big on diversity, right?
Not just included, but also valued.
Mm.
And that goes back to the promotion statistics. You know, we need to really value the different perspectives and experiences and knowledge that they bring to the organization.
So I think on that note, what has been positive is the recent announcement that the 2013 APS census, which closed recently, will for the first time include more questions designed to capture data about cold people and their experiences in the APS. So previous census asked whether an employee was born overseas and whether they speak a language other than English at home. This year, the questions ask employees to describe their cultural backgrounds in more detail. And I expect that this will actually help the APS to get more data about the experiences of people once they've actually come into the APS and track it across time. As a bit of a data nerd myself, I think these things are really important because what matters gets measured. And without that data, we don't have a starting point for benchmarking, for assessing progress, or for making sort of the proactive changes that we want to see in the community. So hopefully the survey results will help to inform agencies' programs and workforce planning and assess how they're tracking. But I also hope it will help inform the Australian Public Service Commission's cold strategy, which they've recently announced and which they're expecting to release in the middle of the year. So if I could give a quick plug for that strategy as well, if you have questions or suggestions for the strategy, or if you just want to share your own experiences on diversity and inclusion in the APS, you can get in touch with the task force at Cold Strategy, that's CALDSTRATEGY, at apsc.gov.au. Thank you, Jennifer and Yoon, for sharing your insights and giving us your time and your stories. It's been a fantastic conversation. It gives us a lot to think about how the community ought to reframe how we think and talk about China, particularly to Chinese Australians and to Chinese Australians who might actually aspire for a career in the national security community and be part of those strategic conversations and to be advising government on what is probably one of the most complex and challenging relationships we have today and in the years ahead. So thank you, Yoon, and thank you, Jennifer.
Thanks, Olivia.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you to the listeners.
Thank you to the listeners. And on that, listeners, if you have any comments that you'd like to provide or feedback on this episode or on the podcast series in general, please get in touch. Our email is natsecpod, so natsecpod at anu.edu.au. Bye for now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.